We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Ted Oakley, author and also the founder and managing partner at Oxbow Advisors. Thanks for joining me today, Ted.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
So you recently went over a chart in your market update that showed that we are at the highest point ever in percentage of stocks contained in the Russell 3000 that have negative earnings, higher than in 2000 and also 2009. Is this time somehow different?
I don't think so, Tom. I mean, if you take that number and then you take the number of companies that are selling for 10 times sales, you'll see that, you know, the speculative activity is rampant, actually. Now we have speculation of speculation. So we see that for sure. And, you know, if you just look at the Russell 2000 and let's say the top two stocks in there, like Hertz and AMC, then you know where you are. I mean, we're in this age of let's just buy it, everything will work out and things will be fine. But we don't think it's different. We'll say that. We do not think it's different this time.
So how could the slowing economy and real estate market in China affect the U.S. and where would those effects start to be seen first?
Well, one of the things that was going to affect us, I think, for sure, is the fact that they cut off their potash and phosphate sales that they were doing. And they were about, you know, in phosphate, they were about 35% of the market. So that's probably going to get the price. That keeps the pressure on fertilizer. And I think people forget about everything that goes into all of these things. You know, I know China, they seem to be turning within and saying, you know, we're going to be staying alone now and we're going to do more things for ourselves. Sort of a reflection of almost like the 30s, where people said, you know, we're going to think about our country first. They seem to be going that direction as far as we can tell.
It seems like fertilizer is a, you know, an area that could really see a lot of cost upturns, basically. If China's cutting off exports and also the cost of natural gas is rising, which again, as you're talking about, this is one ingredient that goes into fertilizer that a lot of people don't think about. Is fertilizer, you know, near the top of your list for assets that are really going to explode here?
Well, we own fertilizer. And if you look at what we own and the strategy where we have a lot of inflation protection is a high cash flow strategy because that's where we can get a lot of cash flow. But in that, we have fertilizer, we have seed, we have timber, we have metals, we have energy, oil and gas. So we have a number of things that really will benefit from inflation. And so far they have actually, but fertilizer is certainly one. And you'll notice that, you know, a lot of these farmers now are not putting on as much. For example, they're not putting as much on the corn. So you're going to probably have a little bit lesser corn crop than you normally would. And all of that just feeds together. And all of a sudden, you know, prices are up. Mm-hmm.
So Ted, when we think about, you know, the housing market, you've talked many times about that. Could we see a reversion to the mean as housing prices tend to follow the trajectory of CPI over time?
Well, we should. What happens normally, I think what's happening now, it's interesting. In the early 80s, you couldn't buy a house because the interest rates were too high. You were looking at 16, 18% interest rates. So I was a young person at the time and I was working, but you had to get a lot of money down to make it work. And that was a problem. Now it's just the reverse. Now the price is too high. And so a lot of these entry-level people can't get into a home unless they want to drive an hour and a half. And so that's the problem you're going to run into is that the prices themselves slow down that business, we think. We think we're getting close to that point right now. You know, you're $400,000 on the average price of a home. So it's getting close.
So when we think about how much currency that has been borrowed into existence in the last 2 years, is it as effective as creating growth in GDP as a function of creating this debt, Ted?
Well, not at all, Tom. What happens is, you know, we monitor every dollar that goes into debt that the government borrows and how it runs through and comes out on the other side as far as GDP. And it's been in a decline now for 20 years. And so we only get about, you put a dollar of debt on right now, you get about 30 cents in GDP. Obviously, you're not getting dollar for dollar. So our federal government is not using their heads in this respect, because the more debt you add on, the lower that number goes. So eventually, it doesn't work at all. And so we're low in that number right now. It's a good point.
So considering that, considering the declining return on these dollars, are there any bonds worth buying or owning in this environment?
Not for us. I mean, I will tell you what we do. We have a very conservative strategy. We only have three strategies, but one of the strategies is really conservative. And the bonds we have in there are really short term. They're basically less than 48 months. And what we've done to enhance that yield, which we've never done before, but it worked, we just felt like this was the thing to do, is we own about 15 to 20% of high yielding preferreds. Basically too big to fail banks. And what that allows us to do is use that preferred as sort of a perpetual bond, if you want to have it that way. So we have about 20% tagged to the long end, if you want to look at it like that. Those are 5 to 5.5% yields. And then you have the other 80% is really short. So we're protected in case you get a big move to the upside, which you could get, but we're just trying to get that number up to where it almost equals the 10-year bond, but you're not having to go out 10 years, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Ted, before we hit record, you were mentioning that you weren't surprised to see that Jay Powell was renominated. Of course, we're speaking here on the morning of Monday, the 22nd of November. So why were you not surprised to hear that news?
Well, I thought, Tom, that if he went the direction of deciding to name Brainerd as the chair, that means Powell would be out. He wouldn't be on at all. And then in addition to naming one new person to the chair, he has to name three new people to the Board of Governors. We have six other governors, 14-year terms. We have three of those open right now. I don't ever remember the time in my career when we had that many openings. So I didn't think he would go that direction, because he needed to keep some semblance of consistency in this whole thing. And I think that's the reason he went in that direction.
So in your opinion, Ted, are we going to see a more hawkish or dovish Powell going forward? Are we going to see, you know, the tapering schedule continue?
You know, it's interesting about Jay Powell. I think he, over the past 2 years, he's sort of laid down to whatever Congress wanted and the direction they wanted to push him in. But if you get into this period here, let's just say inflation stays pretty sticky. I'm talking about 5 or 6% over the next 3 or 4 months. Then he's in a position where he can't. He's really tough either way. If he tries to loosen up because the economy is fading a bit, that won't work because you inflate more. And he has to look at it and say, well, we're either going to have to stop buying bonds a lot, or we'll have to take the rates up. The next 90 days will go a long way in deciding where he's going to land. But if he stays there higher, he has to do something.
So, Ted, when you think about hedging for inflation, do you prefer to take a more balanced approach between several different assets so that one can be working while another is not?
We try to, Tom. You know, we love real estate. We think real estate is not only a great investment in normal times, but we think it's a great investment during inflationary times. But we'll own common stock. Common stocks will help you too if you can buy them right. They're really expensive right now. But then, if you, in addition to that, you have to own the commodities, you know, in some whatever form you want to own them in. But you have to have a spread of those things to really make it work right. I think people that are they're staying with this sort of mantra of the 60-40 portfolio, that 40% bonds. We did a piece last year entitled "There is no 40%. And what we meant by that was, if you're only going to pay me 1.5% for the next 10 years, you know, why bother? You know, go another direction. So that's where we are on sort of on that look.
So Ted, when you think about how real estate is seemingly overvalued at the time, where do you decide to kind of take your gains in that investment?
Well, you have to look. One of the things we mentioned to people recently is that, because we've heard this line many times, and you're picking people that are selling business for these extraordinary levels and pieces of real estate. And what we've said to them is, look, if we get paid a price that is absolutely nuts for a piece of property that we know they can't make any money at, we need to sell it, okay? The idea that people say, well, I don't know what to do with my money. If you get an extraordinary expensive price, what you should do is just sit on it, because you're probably not going to see that again. And that's what we're starting to see in real estate. We're starting to see these cap rates at a level at where the buyers are really doing nothing but betting on the come and trying to get the rates up on the rent rates. And that's a tough trade right there, because if you go through slower times, that won't happen. So on the real estate side, you have to, I would say we've seen less that we, and we like real estate, don't get me wrong, but we've seen less things to buy in the last 3 or 4 months than we've really ever seen since I've been in the business.
As we see parts of the economy that are inflating, Ted, you know, we look around, what do you see as a trend here? Are we seeing parts of the CPI really inflating a lot more than others? And do you think that this is anything but transitory?
Well, I think it's going to be, as my friend Jim Bianco would say, persistent. And what I mean by that is that maybe we don't go to, you know, I don't think we go to 7, 8, 9% or something like that. However, I do think you stick at 3 or 4%, which is well above the 1.5% we've seen the last 2 or 3 years. And there's a lot of other factors in there. Just look at trucking. You know, the Teamsters new contract comes up in June of 22. Mm-hmm. And the truckers are complaining now because they pull up in these ports and, you know, they don't have enough people to unload. So the trucks are just stuck. And people wonder why all this is happening. And so there's so many things in that go on, but that's just one area. But if you look at food, and you know, the basics are food, energy, and housing, they all look to us, at least, to say that for the time being, they're going to stay high.
So are we likely to see the month-over-month inflation rates continue to grow, but kind of shift between these different parts of the CPI as costs in one sector can affect costs in another down the road?
Well, that's a good point, Tom. One of the things that probably happens, you know, when you look at the owner's equivalent rent piece of that, you know, it's a 6-month average, and we only had 1 or 2 months in it so far. So in that average, we're going to pick up another 4 months in here, and that's going to actually push CPI itself, even if you had oil fall off a bit, or maybe even food prices. And I don't look for food prices to fall off that much, but you can see a balancing there where you have maybe rents will pick up the pace, maybe energy stalls or just falls a little bit, but generally, they all stay in that upper territory.
So, Ted, the last time we spoke, you said that you would prefer owning the direct assets versus owning indexes or ETFs. Why is that?
Well, one of the problems about ETFs and indexes will be, in our opinion, and it hasn't been the last 10 years. I mean, I can't argue with the fact that if you bought the index in the last 10 years or exchange-traded funds, you did well. But it's become a growing fad. And what's happened is when you own an index or you own an ETF, what happens is you own every single stock in that particular index. Good ones, bad ones, ones that don't make any money. And if you go into a lot of these indexes today, they have a lot of companies up at the upper end, Tom, that make no money. They just happen to be meme stocks and people are buying them. And they become a big part of the index. We don't own those. The only way you can get around that is to be actively managed. And I know people will say, hey, that doesn't work, but it actually really does. I mean, if you look at, even though we're running about 25% liquid, our cash equivalent returns are fine. And we own individual companies. So I think that's a bit of a misnomer for people, but and they tend not to look at cash adjusted. They tend to just say X is Y, but it's not the same thing. But we have a hard, we think when the bear market comes, that the indexing and the exchange traded funds will be, they will bear the brunt of it. That's where you'll get all the selling.
Interesting. So Ted, would you expect to see a correction in housing that would go along with a bear market or a stock market correction, as you were just mentioning?
Tom, if you go back, and I don't have a chart with me, but if you go back and look at this, and we run this for probably 30 or 40 years, real estate has an impact when the market's going down. It impacts real estate. And it's easy to see why. All of a sudden, I feel poorer. You know, my 401k is down. My assets are down in price. So while I was thinking about maybe stepping up in that next piece of property, you know, I think I'll pass. But what also goes along with the bear market is the economy is slower. And that affects commercial. So, yeah, they go hand in hand more than people think. A lot of times they'll say, well, real estate never gets affected. It does get affected. I can give you numbers of periods when it did, but you have to know that when the market breaks, it will have an impact on the real estate market too.
Ted, could we see the aging population and demographic that owns the majority of stocks be a risk to the equity market as well?
You could. I would say, Tom, I've talked to, you know, a lot of people come by to see us or they get in touch with us and see us somewhere. And one of the things I've noticed is that a lot of people over 70 and 80, by the way, own too many stocks. They're in the market too much. We used to have an old saw on Wall Street that you wanted to have about 100 minus your age in stocks. I think now with people living longer, we use 110 minus your age. But still, I see a lot of these people with too much stock, and they don't really have enough money to do that. One of the things we find about the ultra wealthy is they always have cash, and they're never all on one asset or the other. And I think the average investor could learn something from that.
So when you think about how you split up a portfolio for your clients, you have kind of three different classes. Can you tell us what those are, Ted?
We can. One of the reasons we do that, we have a kind of, if you go to our website, you'll see we have something called base capital, investment capital. And we find that you need a base capital. That's what we run in something called our conservative income strategy. Never had a down year, basically. Don't get me wrong, it doesn't have a huge return this year. Had a good return last year. It's still up for the year. But what happens in that strategy is that's the money we call that you live to play another day. That's survival money, because you have to have some of that. If you get into a period where negative returns are really strong, if you want to keep your emotional self intact, you've got to have something, you know, okay, I always know this is here and I'm good with it. Okay. But on the investment capital side, it can be volatile or whatever. And so that's what we do on the stock side. We have a growth stock strategy, nothing but growth stocks. It's not a cash flow. And then in the middle, we have what we call a high cash flow strategy that is designed to beat the bond market, which it does, but it doesn't own any, we don't own any bonds. But it's just designed to do that because we have high cash flow in that. And that's something we started that 30 years ago. A lot of business owners that sell companies don't have any more cash flow. So they look to us for that. And that's one of the areas we get it.
So what kind of assets do you include in the sleeping money category, as you call it, the passive, you know, rainy day fund?
Sure. Well, you have to have things that we would consider, you know, as bulletproof as you can get it. So, you know, you start with treasuries and CDs. We'll buy short-term municipal bonds. You know, they need to be right now. We're buying them less than 2 years, and we don't get a huge return on them, much better in the money market. And then we put those together, and then we use a lot of floating rate U.S. treasuries. One of the things we like about those is that they adjust every 90 days. And so if rates are going to press upward, we're going to adjust to them every 90 days. We like that segment too. And then we'll own, like I mentioned before, we'll own a piece, not a large piece, but a piece of the preferreds that give us over 5. And those are primarily too big to fail banks. And so you put it all together, and it gives you a decent return.
So which category to you, Ted, does let's say physical gold or gold miners fit into?
Gold miners, and we own both. We own physical gold and we own gold miners, and they're in the high income strategy. And the reason they are is because we own them. Actually, we do own 4%. I shouldn't say that. We own 4% outright gold too in the conservative strategy that I just talked about. But we own the miners and the gold in the high income strategy. And we feel like that if you're going to try to keep buying power intact, you're going to have some segment, you know, in gold. I know people are you know, they're looking at it as thing as doesn't work anymore, but We think this 1850 area is interesting to us because it's gotten up here and stayed. And that's telling us that it's better off than people think it is, probably.
So, Ted, what do you think that gold is going to need to really get, you know, started again and move past that 1850, 1950 dollar level?
Well, you know, Tom, it may be going into 22 before you ever get it, but I happen to think that we'll go higher. We'll like to make a new high in gold about 2000 in 2022. Why do I think that is? Because as you get into an economy, they're going to pass this $1.7 trillion bill that they have. It's primarily giveaways. And it's just one more area where we have a whole group in Washington that has no idea what $1 trillion is. So, you know, they'll do $1 trillion and $1.75 trillion and this, that, and the other. And it will, you know, really, it's amazing to me to look at all these people, both sides, where they don't give any, they have no idea what's happening. And so what I see happening is if you look at negative real rates, which we have right now, you know, it looks like negative real rates are going to stay here. And if they do, that's going to be good for gold.
So, Ted, I'd like to go back to the cash flow strategy that you were talking about before as well. How do you look at the assets that you hold in that? Do you look at, you know, dividend yielding stocks? How do you generate cash flow?
Well, we have an entire mix. We have I'll just start at the top, but we have a lot of preferred stocks, and we have a lot of convertible preferred stocks. All of those pay anywhere between, you know, 4.5 and 7. Then in addition to that, we own, if we like it, we don't have many of these right now because we can't find them, but we do like convertible corporate bonds if we have one of those that's out there. We want an upside piece if the stock goes up, because just to buy a straight bond wouldn't work for us. Then you'll see where we own a large percentage in real estate investment trusts. We're real big in real estate, so we like that area. Now that's going to give us anywhere between, depends on the item, anywhere between 4.75 and say 9%, depending on which ones they have. We have a lot of gas pipelines. We have the largest, really largest allocation this year to pipes and energy companies we've had in many years. We're about 20%, but we own overriding royalty companies. And you look at Texas Pacific and Brigham Minerals, those kind of companies. We own Chevron, for example. We own Kinder Morgan. We own One Oak. All of those things, if you go in and look at the cash flows on them, we own Enterprise Products, Marathon, you know, and so you look at those cash flows and they're all up there in that 7-8% level. Some of them are 9. And then you'll find that we have, in addition, we've got probably three common stocks, a couple of medical companies, and then we have just bought Unilever back. It's a 4% dividend. But you put it all together and you come up with a really good cash flow number, and you have some upside. I mean, if we're right on and we own in there also, we own 5%, which is split between gold miners and gold. We don't get a lot of cash flow off that, but we like the upside.
So, Ted, when you think about, you know, your exposure to oil in the grand scheme of things, do you think that this is a time to be also investing in green energy, or do you think that oil is here to stay for the foreseeable future?
Well, I've said all along, Tom, that I'm not against green energy or anything like that. I just think that the administration and everybody has their timeline wrong, that we can't get situated into that in the length of time of what they want. And I don't think they realize that at this point. If I were looking at the green energy side, though, what I'd be looking at would be any company that really supplies technology or things along that line on the supply side to that business. I think if you get into sort of the revenue side of that, necessarily that can be up or down on you so to speak. But I think the people that do the technology supply side of that business have a good upside, and, you know, we'll see how it goes. I just think the timeline is off. I think, and you know, you look at all these electric car companies and everything, they're way in front of themselves. And that's where I think we are today.
And what do you emphasize in the stock account? What is the framework that you use to find companies that can rise even in a downturn, as you've said?
Well, Tom, we're looking for companies that can grow 15% a year, we think, over the next 5 years. They need to have fairly low debt, and they need to have some cash. Now, what we're finding now is a lot of the companies we already own, they'll bump up against their where they're overvalued, and we won't add those, for example, to a new account. And then some companies we own will drift back. I'll give you an example. Look at PayPal as a good example. We started adding that back. We turned some of it out, but then we started buying it back. Charter Communications, same way. What happens is we like a company. We have a company we think can really grow. You know, then we stay with it. And really, we may come and go with little parts of it, but generally, we're trying to own companies that we can own, say, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Most individual investors, the error they make is they get a good buy on something, goes up 20%, they sell it, then it goes up 200%. So we own them a long time, or try to, for sure.
You've said before that you have very strict parameters on what you want to pay for certain investments. So how do you determine those buy points, Ted? And do you ever revisit those evaluations?
Well, what we're looking for on, I'll just take the stock side first, but on the stock side, what we're looking for, if we're buying a company and we, let's say that we try to think about what they can make over the next 5 years, we discount that back for an inflationary number we want to use. Right now, we're probably using somewhere around 3-4%. To see what the present value of what that would be. If we were using an average multiple, say 15 times, then we try to buy that item about 20% below that price. So we think we're getting a double count here. So we get value, but we also get it cheaper than normal. Now, don't get me wrong, when things are like they are now, we don't get too many that fall in that category, but we do get some when they fall in the category. On the high cash flow side, what we're looking for there is we're trying to find anything that can pay us maybe 3 points over inflation. You know, that's what we're shooting for. And so we've found that what we're trying to do is if the bond market is down, almost every bond fund this year is down 2% or more, some down 3 or 4. While we're up quite a bit in that cash flow stream, but see, we don't own any straight bonds in there. We just own things that are in between. But cash flow is important, and I think people forget about it sometimes, but it's a real important part of the whole picture.
Excellent, Ted. As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
You know, the only thing I would say, Tom, is that I know it's almost like the boy that cried wolf the last 2 years. People think that, hey, you know, you didn't like the market 2 years ago. We didn't like it all that much. We had a little more cash than we probably had, about 30% cash. But the reason we have 25 is because the prices have gone up, not because we've tried to put more in the market necessarily. But I think what people will realize eventually, okay, is that you can't pay $10 for a dollar or $10 for zero and expect to get something in return for that. And I think eventually that's what will come home out of this whole thing.
Absolutely, Ted. You know, the value investing mindset and the absolute, you know, value of things seems to be skewed at the moment. And it's only a matter of time, it seems, before that that resolves itself, right?
Well, it's when I call it the speculation of speculation, I just see too many people doing things that it make no sense at all. And usually, in my lifetime, at least, things that never made, when you look at it, they don't make any sense at all. They eventually don't make sense. So that's where we are right now.
Excellent. Of course, we can find more from you and your market updates at oxbowadvisors.com. And you guys are also on Twitter at oxbow_advisors. Anywhere else you'd like to point to, Ted?
Well, those are the two primary things. You'll see almost everything we do on the website. And of course, we work all over the country in about 30 states. So, you know, if we can help you in any way or you want some information, just go to the website.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time today, Ted.
All right, Tom. Thanks.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.